Thank you. And I've gotten some requests from the online people. As you know, we're live streaming here. So we're joined by people literally around the world who listen to the show, watch it. And one of the requests they had is they have a hard time hearing the questions and comments you make. And we used to have a couple of microphones here. We don't have them anymore. We do, right here, in here. Well, maybe we can put them a little bit closer to the class. But what they've asked is, if you do make a question or comment, could you make it a little clearer, louder? And if not, remind me to repeat the question. So if you can't hear it, chances are they're not going to be able to hear it either. So just please remind me to repeat the question. And I think sometime in the future, we're going to have some of the roving mic go by, which I think could make it a lot easier. And as you heard Ross point out, when we have a guest speaker, please let the guest speaker speak and hold your questions to the end. I mean, all of them are really good at leaving time for questions because unlike me, they can't come back. I'm okay with you interrupting me at any time because I know I can always pick up the lesson where we left off next week. But with a guest speaker, they don't have that luxury. So yeah, whenever there's a guest speaker, please let them finish their message and then you can ask your questions. And also I want to say amen to what Ross said. If you've got six questions, maybe ask one or two. Let someone else jump in, and you can always ask your questions when everybody else is done with their questions. Now, I think I got a problem with my computer. Last week, you recall, I was putting in connectors here, and they weren't working. I bought two brand new ones. Well, guess what? None of the new ones worked, and the one that worked last week that I got from Phil, it doesn't work this week either. So we're not going to have visuals today, which is too bad because I really prepared some great visuals for you to see. I'm hopefully going to try to describe what I've prepared, so it won't have quite the same impact, and hopefully next week we'll actually have this problem solved. By the way, all the rest of my connectors work great, but just not the the VGA. You know, as I was walking towards this class, how many of you got to hear the service this morning? I mean, it was a really good message, right? Yes. But several of you were asking me questions thinking maybe Josh was saying something that was counter to what I was saying about the judgment of believers. I've had several good meetings with Josh. There really is no difference. And, you know, I think people are just misunderstanding. You go all the way to the last sentence of his message. So I'm going to open up to where he was talking. And I will get this taken care of. So, yeah. And 1 Corinthians 3 and 4, where Josh has been preaching the last few weeks, has been talking about the judgment day for believers. And you've heard me say in the class, on judgment day for believers, we will not have to give an account for the sin and evil we've committed, because that's been taken care of by Christ's work on the cross. It's basically an award ceremony. But as you read the first five verses of 1 Corinthians 4, it does talk about how we're going to have to give an account before the Lord. We're going to be judged by the Lord, not just unbelievers, but believers will be judged as well. But notice the last sentence in Josh's message this morning from the text, 1 Corinthians 5, at that time, referring to believers, each will receive his praise from God. Notice what it's saying there. You're each going to receive praise from God. It's not God shaking his finger at you and saying, you shouldn't have done that. That's all been taken care of at the cross. But also notice that Paul is being very serious here, that at the judgment seat, all the bad stuff in your life is going to be taken out, and you're going to have to give an account for the stuff that deserves the praises. That's the stuff you give an account for. And basically, Paul is saying, take it seriously. And I'll give you an analogy. You know, my sons went to a Lutheran school for high school, and there were about 250 students in the class. And I remember they were giving out awards at the end of the school year. Well, guess how many awards they gave out? 250 students, they gave out 450 awards. And every student got an award. But the award you didn't want to get was the most improved award. Okay? That's the one that basically said, okay, we couldn't find anything else to give you an award for, so we're giving you this. And that's basically what Paul is saying here, is that take your life here on earth seriously, because you will gonna have to give an account for your service before the Lord, your work before the Lord, the good works that God has prepared in advance for you to do. That's Ephesians 2:10. And basically making the point here, and I love the way Josh pointed it out, we can't take credit for any of the good stuff we've done. It's stuff that God prepared in advance for us to do. He literally put it right in front of us. But yeah, we'll have to give an account for the good things, the things that are worthy of praise. And everyone will receive his reward. Everyone will receive his praise. And you say, what's this judgment stuff all about? Well, 1 Corinthians 3, 12-15 talks about we go through a refining fire. Because no matter how well you've lived your life as a Christian, in these decades you've had here on earth, you die being obnoxious. Every human being here, everyone in this class, is obnoxious to one degree or another. And it's such that when we enter into the new creation, you're going to say, gee, do I really want to spend the rest of eternity with that guy? Well, no worries. That guy will have gone through the refining fire. All that obnoxious stuff will be burnt away. It'll be gone. There'll be nothing obnoxious by any one of us. And aren't you glad all of us go through refining fire? Isn't it going to be really wonderful? And guess what? We're all going to need it. But what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 3 is some of us will need to kind of stay in that refining fire a little longer than others. And so, again, it's to our benefit to allow the Holy Spirit to transform your life as a believer walking in front of him, because that means there'll be less dross that'll have to be removed. But all of us have got some dross. All of us have got to go through that refining fire, because none of us ends this life being totally morally perfect and pure. Yes?
I'm against purgatory, but playing devil's advocate, it's refining fire and period of time in refining fire. That almost sounds like purgatory.
Okay.
In a sense.
Well, it would if you're kind of spending a trillion years going through the refining fire. I don't think that's the way it is. I think it's just like that, and the dross is taken out. And it does not delay the award ceremony. You know, as I look at what the text says here and also in the book of Revelation, we all are present at the award ceremony. So again, think of that high school example. All the students are there in the class. The awards are all given out at the same time. Nobody has to wait. They all have to go through the 4 years of high school. So that part, which is analogous to this life we live here on earth, there we're waiting. But once we die, as it says, I like the fact that Josh gave that text, Hebrews 9:27, is given unto men once to die and then the judgment. But the judgment is immediate. We're all there at the awards ceremony. We're all going to get our rewards and the praises at the same time, but it'll be different. Some will get more, some will get less. Some will have to have a little more of that dross removed than others, because some enter in with more dross. That's why it says some will escape this refining fire and they'll have their salvation intact, but for a few, there won't be a whole lot else there. They're going to get that most improved award. Okay. Yes, Jim.
Now, since we have to be cleansed by temperature, how about a nice warm bath?
Well, I think it uses the refining fire again as an analogy, is that God's going to do something to us to remove the obnoxious stuff that we have in our life. I don't think it's a literal fire. But it's something that is efficacious in removing all that stuff out of your life, so that everyone you meet in the new creation is going to be obnoxious free, which means we're all going to be excited about spending eternity with one another. It's like, I'm not going to be able to spend enough time with all of you, good thing, because I think God's going to give us the capacity to have eternal fellowship with everybody simultaneously. So, of course, it's really important that that dross be removed. Otherwise, it wouldn't be quite so exciting to have to spend an eternal conversation with everybody simultaneously. Yes.
Plus, just to put it in context, getting back to the purgatory comment, his audience was believers, right?
Yes.
So this is the people at the award ceremony,
right?
But not everybody will be at the award ceremony.
Not everybody will be at the award ceremony. I mean, we spent some time as class years ago going through those three chapters in Ezekiel, which contrasts the judgment day of believers with the judgment day of unbelievers. When it comes to unbelievers, none of the good that they ever perform here on earth will be judged. It's only those things that displease God. We did a little object lesson here. Remember the scales we had here? Well, some of you weren't here. We're talking like 10 years ago. But I brought a set of scales here, had all your good deeds on one side, your bad deeds on the other side. And what does it say in Ezekiel 18? Is that God will look at you and say, okay, who did you side to give glory to, yourself or to God? Who did you submit your life to? And if it's not for God, he takes that scale with all the good stuff on it and dumps it and weighs you in the balance. On the other hand, if you've dedicated your life to God, he takes that scale with all the bad stuff on it and dumps it and weighs you in the balance. So it's 100% good deeds against 0% bad deeds for the believer. It's the flip side for the unbeliever. 0% good deeds, 100% bad deeds. And if you read the text, the Jews who are counting on their good deeds outweighing their bad deeds, they scream at Ezekiel and say, this is not fair. We want to be weighed in the balance where everything is weighed. And Ezekiel basically explains, that's not to your advantage. Because God's going to look at the motive for all those good deeds you've done. That's where he's going to judge you. And if the motive is not to bring glory to God, he would have to transfer that good deed and put it on the other side, and that's not going to go well for you. God's doing you an enormous favor. He's simply going to dump all that good stuff. And we're just going to weigh you on the stuff that... Yeah, go ahead.
Here's my
Ross.
Question. Does that mean that all Christians are going to receive the same reward?
No. No. It says each one will receive his praise, each one will receive his reward. It will be different rewards. And likewise, for those who choose not to spend eternity with God, they get different levels of what it says in... Revelation 20, torment. Interesting thing about the word torment that's used in Revelation 20. It means that which restrains. Basically making the point, in order to prevent hell from being a worse place than otherwise would be, God has to put different levels of restraint on the individuals in proportion to the evil they commit. Well, the flip side for the believers is we get different levels of reward in proportion to the service we perform for Jesus Christ while we're here on earth. So not everybody gets the same reward. And keep in mind, we all get different careers. To put it another way, a big component of your reward will be the career you'll have in the new creation. And it's kind of like going to university today. If you choose to stop at the AA degree, that will have some impact on the career path you can choose. Whereas if you go all the way to get 3 degrees, you get to perform. So again, based on how you prepared yourself for life in the new creation, you'll get different careers. However, the promise is this. You're going to get a reward that'll be the maximum of your carrying capacity. Just that not all of us will have the same carrying capacity. In other words, your life here on earth has the potential to increase your ability to receive a reward and a career from God. Bottom line is, we're all going to be totally fulfilled because we're going to get the maximum that we're able to handle. But Paul's message is, consider this life here on earth. You can increase that maximum, and this is the only time you got a chance to do it. You're not going to get another opportunity. Yes, Steve.
One thing of comfort, maybe going back to Josh's area of 1 Corinthians 3, 12, talks about the works of wood, hay, and stubble, or gold, silver, precious stones tested. That's not us, that's our works. So we can still take a hot bath and have our works be in the fire.
Sure.
Yet it goes on to say something very poignant, that if any man's work does not survive, he will
but any person whose works does survive will receive a reward. So there is consequence to what we do now as to work, what our eternity will be.
Right. Yeah. Just like that analogy of 250 students getting 450 rewards, some wind up with 6 rewards. Some wind up with only 1. So, and you know, some wind up with more prestigious rewards. It's kind of like that. Again, poor analogy, but that's kind of how it goes. Yes?
Now, what is the difference between, you're talking about the awards and the crowns that they talk about?
Okay, well, crowns are a specific category of rewards. It's not the total sum of rewards we receive in the new creation. They're designated rewards, and basically they're guarantees. Basically saying, if you've achieved this in your life as a Christian here on earth, you will get this crown. And we did a study on the crowns here. There are, what, 5 or 6 different crowns that are mentioned in the Bible? And basically we're saying, hey, if you want to secure a reward, just do this, and you'll get that crown. It's guaranteed. So now, all of us get at least 1 crown because it's called the crown of life, which means if you've given your life to Christ and said, hey, you know, run my life. I don't want to run it anymore. I want to receive your gift of redemption. Then you get that crown of life. So, yeah, we're all going to get 1. And then when it says, no matter how many crowns you get, say you get the full lot. And incidentally, there might be 1 crown that would be a little bit uncomfortable to get. There's a special crown for being killed for your faith in Jesus Christ. So not all of us are too excited about getting that crown. But for those who experience it, they get a special crown. But notice what the text says too. After all the crowns are given to the saints, what do the saints do? They place all the crowns at the foot of Jesus. They give the crowns back in recognition that it's the work of Christ and the work of Christ alone that even makes that possible. So we all know that who really deserves those honors. So he's the one that accumulates all the crowns. But it's a comfort to believers in realizing, okay, when I go to that award ceremony, I'm not going to walk away empty. Even if all I've done is given my life to Christ and haven't done anything to serve the Lord beyond that, I get that crown. So you might be able to scroll back about 4 or 5 years. We did a little review of the study we did in crowns 35 years ago. And so we'll move on. Yes. Anyone else? Yes.
So I go to a Bible study once a week with some Lutheran guys. They're very, very adamant about rewards. Everybody's reward is the same. You know, like that there is no like tiers or something like that. Do you know the passages in the Bible that talks about like these crowns and the different like the benefits of?
Well, let's just stick with the crowns idea. So if you heard the question, is there some segments of the church that believe that every Christian gets the identical reward, enter the new creation? The crowns by themselves are evidence that that can't be true. So for example, not all of us are going to get the martyr's crown. Only those who have been killed for the faith get that crown. So they get a crown the rest of us don't get. So by that token alone, and likewise, there's a crown that's given to people for those who've brought people to faith in Jesus Christ. A lot of us have done that, but again, not everybody has. So when you look at the different crowns, only one of those crowns is given to every believer. The rest of them, so some of us will get 3 crowns, some 2, some 1. A rare group will get all of them. So we do get different levels of reward. And keep in mind, there's a balance here. Revelation 20 is explicit that there are different levels of torment in the lake of fire. That parallels the fact that there's different levels of reward that we have in the new creation. We also see the promise we're not all going to be sitting on harps or on clouds playing harps. No, we're all going to have careers. We're going to be managers and teachers and judges over the angels and over who else God creates in the new creation. And so we're going to have these careers, and the careers will be meted out in proportion to the preparation and training that you've been able to achieve based on this life here on earth. And so in that sense, there's a difference. So, and Paul's, I mean, just look what we see here in 1 Corinthians 3 and 4. Basically, Paul is exhorting believers, take these decades you have here on earth seriously, because it has an eternal impact, and not all of us will be impacted the same way. And so, basically saying, hey, and incidentally, taking your Christian life seriously is also fun. So Paul is really making the point, look, this isn't a burdensome thing God's putting upon you to take seriously the good works he's prepared in advance for you to do. This is going to bring you great joy right here on earth. You get a reward right now. You don't have to wait till the new creation. I mean, there you'll get a greater reward. As it says, no one can imagine how good and great the reward will be. And incidentally, if you're worried about getting that most improved reward, 1 Corinthians 2:9 says, no matter how lowly your reward is in the new creation, it'll be greater than any one of us right now can think or imagine how good and wonderful it'll be. So, hey.
My vote is you teach us about the new physics.
Well, we've done that before in the class.
No, I mean in eternity. Your career will be to teach us about the new physics.
Well, and that won't be necessary because you'll all be experiencing the new physics. You'll all be experiencing the transdimensionality, the different laws of physics. But I think is exciting is what it's going to do for our relationships with one another, that we have this new physics. Maybe my job will be to explain the old physics that we used to have. No, in the back over here.
They talk about the rewards in one of the parables about when the master hands out a certain amount of money to several different employees, and he comes back and asks them to report on what became of their money, and some doubled. And then the last one, he just hid his money away. So it just talks about how you use the gifts God gives you here, and you'll get your reward based on how you use those rewards.
Yeah, so that's a good point. I know you all heard that if you look in the New Gospel parables, Jesus talks about the rewards that we were going to receive and how, you know, he gave us good works for us to do, and some were able to take that one talent and make a talent back, some five, some ten. And based on what we did with the opportunities God gave us, what does he say? I'll put you in charge of 10 cities. Basically saying, I'm going to give you a career commensurate with your demonstrated abilities to take advantage of those rewards and careers in this life. So there again, we have an example. It will be different for different individuals. So again, the exhortation is take this life here seriously. Okay, what I have prepared, and I especially did this because we had Ken Wolgamuth here in as you heard, he's a geochemist, and basically using his chemistry as a Christian, as a witness. And last week I got started on this and had failure. But what has happened is there's a principle here I've been talking about in class, how the more we learn about science, the more we learn about nature, the more evidence, the more confidence we have that the Bible is the inspired, inerrant, authoritative Word of God. And what's been published are two papers, and Ken, these are both geology papers, but they were published in the astrophysical journals. So that often happens, mainly because a lot of astronomers are interested in planets. But interestingly, both of these discoveries are relevant here to planet Earth. And I'll just review what I discussed last week, but I promise I would also talk about the discovery that's relevant to the fourth creation day. And again, my apologies, all these wonderful visuals you're not going to be able to see. However, the visuals are all going to be available in two blog articles I'm writing on both of these scientific discoveries. Well, the first one that I briefly reported on last week was about creation day 3, and how creation day 3 talks about how at the beginning of creation day 3, God transforms the planet from a water world to where we have continents and oceans coinciding. And if you flip to Psalm 104, it tells us that once the continents are in place, they're permanent. Never again will earth be a water world. Sometimes I use that verse 9, as evidence that the flood of Noah could not be global in extent. It was the world of the ungodly that was wiped out, not the entire surface of planet Earth, because of the promise we see in Psalm 104 and repeated in Job 38 and Proverbs 8 and two other places in the Psalms, that once the continents are in place, they are permanent fixtures on the Earth. But as I showed you last week, the traditional graph that geophysicists have been showing people about the growth of the continents shows the Earth starting off indeed as a water world, and a couple of small volcanic islands begin, and then you get the first cratons, which are these are mini continents that show up, basically just two, one in what is now South Africa and one in Western Australia. And then there's a relatively sudden increase when the Earth is about 2 billion years old, a little bit less than half of its current age, where it jumps from about 5% up to about 20% of the surface of the Earth being covered with these continents, and it gradually increases from that 20% up to the present 29%. And as I told you last week, a study on 278 drill holes in shale deposits around the world on all seven continents had changed that picture. And for the first time, these geophysicists looked at not only the oxygen 16 to oxygen 18 ratio in the shales, they looked at the oxygen 16 to oxygen 17 ratio. And by combining those two ratios, they were able to determine how rapidly these continents form, because shales are basically the result of a continental landmass material being eroded off the continents and being deposited in the oceans and then being transformed into shales. And what they basically came up with is a graph. Let me pull it up here. You won't be able to see it. But they've now revised this whole story, where for about the first billion years, at best, we got tiny islands, maybe no islands at all. So it's a water world for the first billion years of Earth's history. Then from a billion years to 2 billion years, it jumps from 0% up to just 2%. And then at 2.45 billion years ago, it goes from 2% up to 27%. So very sudden increase, and it happens in less than 130 million years. So by 2.32 billion years after the Earth is formed, we have 27% of the Earth covered with, because it's a very sudden continental landmass growth. Then you get about a 2% addition since that time. And what's interesting is that 2.45 billion years to 2.32 billion years ago, that's coincided with what's called the Great Oxygenation Event. And so this is when you have a lot of carbon dioxide being pulled out of the atmosphere, oxygen's being pumped into the atmosphere. It's also a time when there are ice ages that covered more than 90% of the planet with ice, and that was coincided with this incredible growth of continental landmass. And again, geophysicists are wondering, what drew down the carbon dioxide so dramatically, pumped up the oxygen? Well, if you transform a planet from being only 2% continental landmass to 27%, that will bring about this tremendous drawdown of carbon dioxide and a boost in the oxygen. But as I was reading the paper, making note of the fact that what this is basically saying is that the event we see recorded in Genesis 3 has the impression that we're going to see a dramatic increase in continental landmass, and indeed that's what this newspaper is saying. That it's much, I mean, it was dramatic before, but they're saying it's even more dramatic. So again, I say this is actual evidence that we see recorded in Genesis 1 thousands of years ago is being affirmed even more dramatically than it was, say, last year. Okay, as promised, I'm going to talk to you also about a new discovery about Creation Day 4. And I got the paper here with me. If you want to look at it, just published in the Astrophysical Journal. Great title, Exploring the Atmosphere of the Neoprotozoic Earth, the Effect of Oxygen on Haze Formation and Composition. And nine geophysicists jump in to this particular study. And they're all interested in trying to figure out, so they're actually seeing evidence for haze on planets outside of the solar system. So this is an attempt to actually see what's going on here on the planet Earth. But to give you some background, and this past week, I've been bombarded on my Twitter site by atheists who insist my interpretation of Genesis 1 is totally wrong. And therefore, science has disproven the credibility of the Bible. And I've been kind of tweeting them back with my 288-character limit on why I think my interpretation of Genesis 1 has some legitimacy. And, you know, what these atheists are trying to promote is this idea that the Bible in the first page teaches that God did not create the sun until day 4. And yet we got plants on day 3, and clearly this shows how stupid these ancient people were in thinking you could have plants surviving without the heat of the sun. Well, one of the responses I gave is I don't think the people living thousands of years ago were that stupid. They knew that light and heat from the sun was crucial for these plants to be able to grow. And the text tells us there were plants before we see that event of creation, day 4. But it said it's more obvious than that. If you go to Genesis 1:2, it says the Spirit of God is hovering over the surface of the waters of planet Earth. That's telling you the frame of reference from which we're to interpret the 6 days of creation. And these atheists have been bombarding me. We're insisting, no, we have to interpret it from where God is. He's above the earth, looking down on the earth, and he's telling us what is happening. And I said, well, if that's the point of view, then I would agree with you. Jesus, or Genesis 1, is teaching scientific nonsense. Everything's got to be wrong from that point of view. But if the frame of reference is the surface of the earth, below the cloud layer, notice everything is a perfect fit. So they were basically saying, no, this can't be. And I said, well, I mean, look at the text. It's right there. And also notice that's step one of the scientific method. Don't interpret until you establish the point of view. And Genesis 1 follows that scientific method. It gives you the point of view first. Then I said, what's the second step of the scientific method? The second step is don't interpret until you establish the initial conditions. It says, read what else Genesis 1:2 says. Water over the whole face of the earth. It's dark on the face of the waters, and the earth is formless and void. It's empty of life and unfit for life, and now God begins to work. And they said, well, we think you're totally wrong on that. And I said, well, this isn't the only text. Go to Job. Job also takes you through the content of the 6 days and the context of what's going on before day one. Job 38, verse 8 says that God had blanketed the seas, referring to the waters on the surface of the earth. He blanketed those seas with darkness. He blanketed those seas with clouds that kept the seas dark. So in Job 38, it's explicit why it's dark on the surface of the waters. It's not dark because there is no sun. It's dark because the clouds kept the light of the sun out from reaching the surface of the earth. Now, I saw that right away when I was 17 years of age reading the Bible for the first time, though I admit I probably had an advantage. I knew from my studies in physics that any planet the size of the earth, with the distance it is from its host star, will be formed with an atmosphere that's going to be 100 times thicker than the atmosphere we have today. And with an atmosphere that thick, no visible light will reach the surface of the waters of planet Earth. And if you want a modern-day example of that, think about Venus. Venus has an atmosphere 40 times thicker than, by the way, I was a bit conservative. The latest estimate is that Earth had an atmosphere 200 times thicker than we have today. The old story was 100, but now they're saying 200. Venus, one-fifth, 40 times as thick. But on the surface of Venus today, the only visible light that gets through to the surface is at the far red end of the spectrum. So ordinary red light, orange light, yellow light, green light, blue light, none of that gets through. The atmosphere stops all of that. With Earth, there would have been no visible light reaching the surface at all. It would have been dark. So But again, these atheists were telling me, well, it says in Genesis 1:3 that God created the light on day one. I said, well, if you actually look at the text, it doesn't use the word create. It says, let the light be. And so God created the light in the beginning. There was light when God created the universe, but that light did not reach the surface of the earth until creation day one. And creation day one, light reached the surface of the earth for the first time, and this is what enabled photosynthetic life to occur. And we have isotope evidence that tells us that photosynthetic life was part of the origin of life on planet Earth 3.82 billion years ago. It wasn't just the non-photosynthetic life, it was there too, but you got photosynthetic life. And that would require the light of the sun reaching the surface of the Earth, but it doesn't require that the sun be visible as an object in the sky to creatures on the surface of the Earth. That's creation day four, where it says, let there be the great lights, referring to the sun, moon, and stars. But it goes on in verse 14, let there be the great lights, so that they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. Now, seasons, days, and years for whom? Okay, notice all the life before creation day four is life that's sufficiently primitive. They don't need to know where the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky. They do just fine not knowing that. But when you get to creation day five, that's when God creates the first animals. That's the Avalon and Cambrian explosion of life, followed by God introducing the birds and the mammals. Animals need to know, at least on occasion, where those sun, moon, and stars are in the sky to regulate their biological clocks. They're the first creatures that need to have that. So let there be the great lights, so they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years, which means it's important that those creatures be able to see where the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky in order for them to be able to regulate their biological clocks. Well, this paper basically confirms that indeed it was not possible to see the position of the sun, moon, and stars in the sky until the second great oxygenation event, which occurred 580 million years ago. And I wish I could have shown you a graph, but basically what happens is for the first 2.2 billion years, our atmosphere has between 1/10,000th of a percent oxygen in the atmosphere and 1/1,000th of a percent. Now, that's enough to keep life going here on the planet Earth. But beginning 2.45 billion years ago, that jumps up to somewhere between 1 and 2.5% of the atmosphere. But interestingly, when you get to 2 billion years ago, it drops back down to below 1%. It basically stays at about 1% until 580 million years ago. 580 million years ago, the oxygen content goes from a little less than 1% and suddenly jumps up to 8%. And then shortly thereafter, it jumps up to 10%. The 8% is enough to support the Avalon animals, but not enough to support the Cambrian animals. The 10% is enough to support the Cambrian animals. But what this paper is basically documenting, this was in a laboratory study, where they said, what we're going to do is we're going to simulate the oxygen content in Earth's atmosphere at different levels and see what it does to haze formation. And they took it at 20 parts per million. Now, to put this in context, today oxygen is at 210,000 parts per million. But they started at 20 parts per million, which is where we were in the early history of the Earth. And then they increased it from 20 parts up to 30 to 40. This was all done in a simulated laboratory where they throw in carbon dioxide, methane, nitrogen, the gases we know were in the Earth's atmosphere at the appropriate percentages they were. And this is what they notice. As the oxygen content goes from 20 parts per million up to the present 210,000 parts per million, you get less and less haze. In other words, the production of haze in the atmosphere progressively drops as the oxygen content goes from 20 parts up to 210,000 parts. They also noticed, by citing other research papers in the geophysical literature, that as haze goes up, cloud cover goes up. They also noted by citing other research papers, as the quantity of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere goes up, the cloud cover goes up. So they're basically saying what we notice here is throughout the history of the Earth, the carbon dioxide level was started off extremely high and has dropped down to its present level. And when you got more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you got more cloud cover. If you got more haze, you got more cloud cover. But even the haze by itself would be sufficient to eliminate the possibility that animals could see the sun, moon, and stars with sufficient accuracy and frequency that they could actually regulate their biological clocks. And now you'll see this in the blog paper I'm going to be releasing in a couple of weeks, as I basically show some photographs of really hazy days that we have here on Earth. You don't get too many of them, but if you're in those big Asian cities, they happen pretty frequently, although they call it smog, not haze. And I'm actually going to be showing you a photograph of what it was like here in Los Angeles in 1950. And what's interesting, back in 1950, you drive on the freeways at rush hour, and it's basically open freeway. Can you imagine that? Los Angeles with freeways where there's basically 30 car lengths between each car. That's the way it was in around 1950. And so they show these open freeways with very light traffic on them, but the smog is so dense that the drivers of those cars can only see about half a mile away. So, matter of fact, things were pretty bad when I came here from Canada in 73. It took me several months before I realized there were mountains over there. I mean, those are 6,000 foot high mountains, right? And they're only 3.5 miles north of Caltech. But it took me like 4 months before the clear enough day and I could actually see, oh, we're not that far away from the San Gabriel Mountains. Now, isn't it a blessing that they've cleaned up our air so that we can see that all the time? Even on a bad day, you can still see Mount Baldy and all the mountains. And that's happened. But however, today you got these big eastern cities. And one time we had a gal here in the class that was a visitor. I won't name the city. But her comment was, we had her outside at night. And she says, "What's that thing up in the sky?" And we said, "That's the moon." She had never seen the moon. Although she did say that she knew people who had seen the moon. Okay. But what we found out is the city where she lives, the only time you can see the moon is when the moon is full and near the zenith. If it's below the zenith, the haze basically blocks it out. And, I've been in Shanghai at night on a clear night where there's no clouds, still can't see a single star. No stars at all. And we know there's certain bird species, for example, are critically dependent on being able to use the positions of the stars to regulate their biological clocks. My point is, you don't need a lot of haze before the conditions of creation days 1, 2, and 3 are in effect, where it's simply not possible that you can use the positions of the sun, moon, and stars to regulate the biological clocks that animals need to regulate. But this paper, again, is another example, because no one had ever done this research before. But now it's been done, and basically showing, if the oxygen content is that low, and we know it was that low, you're going to get sufficient haze, you're going to have sufficient carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that it's simply not going to be possible for creatures to be able to see the position of the sun, moon, and the stars in the sky. Moreover, it's kind of like we see with creation day 3. It doesn't say explicitly in the text that this is an immediate, dramatic, sudden event, but the scientific evidence is telling us that interpretation would be appropriate. It'd be appropriate to interpret those texts as really saying, yes, We're going to see this sudden event where the atmosphere goes from translucent to transparent, and now these animals can use these signs. And certainly we see that in the fossil record. You go from no animals to the Earth just being proliferated with animals of all different species and sizes, and all being able to take advantage of the visibility of the sun, moon, and stars. Yes, Jim?
How high up, what altitude do the birds have to fly to? How high is that haze go?
Well, that's something these geophysicists didn't model. They were simply, what they were doing in their paper was modeling, okay, if we have an oxygen content this low, how does it affect the production of a haze aerosols? And basically it said there's a direct correlation or anti-correlation between the quantity of oxygen and haze production. And so if you're talking 20 parts per million, you get a really thick haze. And yeah, I don't think it'd be possible for birds to fly high enough to get above it. But today, yeah, I mean, they've actually seen birds at 26,000 feet on Mount Everest. So evidently they can get that high, not for very long. It's kind of like humans. You can stay a little bit of time up there, but you better get down fast. But they actually do. And I think what's happening is birds are being wafted up in these updrafts, and they spend some time there, and then they drop back down. But yeah, if you're up that high, you're going to get above most of the modern haze. But hey, if we're talking 20 parts or 100 parts per million, probably not. But again, the work hasn't actually been done yet.
Some birds use that for their migration routes, right? They follow the stars?
They do, yeah. A number of bird species actually use the constellations as a guide for their migration routes. And you know, by the way, when I was talking about these Asian cities, you can't even see where the sun is until it gets high up in the sky. So we get to see the sunset. Can you imagine living in a place where you never get to see a sunset or a sunrise because of how hazy and smoggy it is? But there are people like that. Well, we got the geologists. Thank you. Yeah.
I was here in 1960 with my parents visiting Upland and Upland College, where my church environment had its meeting. And it was so foggy, my eyes burned, and we went up to Baldy and got high enough, and it was all clear. You could just see the top of it. So I give incredible praise to all the engineers that did what it took to clean up this valley.
Yeah. Yep. Although there are a number of astronomers that were very disappointed that we cleaned up the smog, because we basically had to shut down Mount Wilson. Yeah. Those telescopes on Mount Wilson took advantage of L.A. smog.
Oh, for light?
Well, not only for light, but for seeing quality. Now that the smog has been cleaned up, the seeing quality of Mount Wilson is nowhere near what it used to be. And, of course, now they've got city lights that make for a problem. And so all the telescopes there, with the exception of the solar telescope, that's still being used by professionals, but the other telescopes are basically... Well, amateur astronomers are now using them. So, yeah, the professionals have basically abandoned them because we cleaned up all the smog here in the L.A. Basin. So, because, yeah, when you had lots of smog here, you had this nice laminar layer running about 4,000 or 5,000 feet above the basin, and it kept all the unstable air underneath that inversion layer. Astronomers loved it. That's why they actually put the telescopes up there. So... And actually, the biggest thing that, because I was like you, and even in 73, my eyes would sting and water literally all the time. And then I remember when that stopped. It stopped when they got rid of all the steel mills.
Steel mills.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you were up at Upland. You go out into the little farther east than that, they had some really big steel mills there. They basically shut those down. Of course, they made our cars have these... that made a big difference. So that's what's amazing. You know, 1950, we didn't have a lot of cars on the freeways, and it was really bad smog. And now we have millions of cars on the freeways, and we don't have those smoggy days anymore. However, Indians who lived here also experienced bad smog in this basin because they had a lot of trees, and trees give off a lot of natural smog. And so just the geography of the LA Basin But we got rid of all the trees, so that helps.
Good job on that one.
Not all the trees, but yes, go ahead, Doug.
Clear day in Pasadena, I saw the mountains, and I thought, no wonder people loved it here 100 years ago. One day in a year.
One day in a year, right.
It was amazing.
Yeah, go ahead.
When I came here in 63, I lived in Inglewood for almost a year, and I complained about my eyes and my nose burning on bad days. He said, well, that's because we still burn some of our trash, but not as much. It's illegal to burn all the trash, including all the carcinogenic plastic, et cetera, et cetera. So, there's a lot more going on in steel mills.
That's true. I do remember when you could burn trash here in the L.A. Basin. Mm-hmm. So, and they had incinerators here. They shut down the incinerators. You couldn't burn trash anymore. It got rid of the steel mills. And they equipped our cars with these converters.
Negative impact on the oncologists, though. So poor oncologists, right?
Yeah, I mean, the doctors that deal with cancer surgeries, they're not getting as much business. So. Although I think they're doing okay because we're all living longer now. And when you live longer, you're going to get cancer. So I think they're doing okay. It's the astronomers I'm concerned about because they all had to go to Chile or Hawaii. They can't go here to California anymore. Isn't that sad? Yeah. Tough place to go. Go ahead. Well, this is, okay, what is changing? Josh mentioned global warming in one sentence. He said he's never going to speak on it, and probably won't. But we've spoken it on here, but global warming is real. And probably the most dramatic evidence of that are those of us living on the West Coast. I mean, my sister who lives in central British Columbia, when she first moved there 30 years ago, every winter they had like 6 weeks of 35 below. She says, the last several winters has never gotten colder than 15 below. And says the lake that she lived on, a huge lake with a 1,000-mile shoreline, says it used to freeze over, it doesn't freeze over anymore. So, and here in L.A., when I first got here in 73, every year you could count on 30 feet of snow on San Gregorio. And I remember when snow would drop down to 1,500 feet on these foothills, doesn't happen anymore. So,
I saw it a couple years ago with the frost level.
And, you know, I remember climbing Mount Baldy. No matter what day you climbed it, even in early August, there is snow on top of Mount Baldy. Yeah. Now, I mean...
That's 7,000 or 8,000 feet, right?
10,000 feet. 10,000. Yeah.
That's considerably more than here.
Yeah, but it used to have permanent snow. Yeah. It doesn't have permanent snow anymore. Yeah, I mean, for 4 months in the summer, there's no snow there. So, however... The global warming models also predict it gets colder in the east. So it gets warmer here, but colder in the east. And notice, east, especially New England, their winters have been a lot more severe.
So that's why we're on the east.
Well, what's interesting
Sometimes
about...
Daniel will remind you of hell here.
All right, I'll let that one go. But I think that's what's kind of driving this idea that this global warming is not real, is that Eastern Asia is getting colder, and Western Europe is getting colder, and Eastern North America is getting colder. Well, guess where all the people live? Those are heavily populated areas. But I think any one of us who have lived here for several decades knows it's not as cold as it used to be.
Is there an obvious explanation why that is?
Well, okay. I'm hoping to get into this class here, Kevin Birdwell. He's the president of our Knoxville chapter. And the next time he comes, I'm going to try to get him to speak here in the class because he's a climatologist. He did his PhD thesis on the climate of the last 60,000 years and says, you know, we've had warming trends like this before.
I didn't mean global warming. I meant why the East is different than the West.
Okay. Well, these climate models are complex. And if Kevin were here, he would tell you it's going to be another 100 years before we get a really reliable climate model. It says we're kind of like where we were with weather forecasting 100 years ago. 100 years ago, we could tell you the weather tomorrow, but not 14 days out. Today, we can tell you the weather 14 days out with reasonable precision, literally all over the world. And we're moving on that in terms of climatology. But the reason why we can do weather forecasting, we've had over a century of really good data. For climate models, you need the same thing. A century, actually a little more than that, of really good data. And we haven't been doing the measurements long enough to do that. However, you can go to the South Pole, you can go to the North Pole, you can go to the Alps. Those are places where they've done deep ice cores. And if you look at the oxygen 16 to 18 ratio, it tells you the global mean temperature at various times. And I could actually show you a slide here, if my computer were able to do it, of the temperature variations over the past million years. Basically, it shows you the cycle of the planet getting warmer, colder, warmer, colder. It drives the ice age cycle. And every time it's gotten about 2 degrees centigrade warmer than where it is right now, you get a rapid drop into an ice age. So yeah, politically, everybody is saying, hey, if we warm the planet, the sea levels are going to rise. Actually, the really big risk is if we warm the planet, the sea levels are going to drop because we're going to dump a whole lot of ice on Canada and Siberia. And the previous ice ages tells us that happens rapidly. You say, how does that happen? Well, the best model I've seen says if you melt the polar ice cap, you evaporate more seawater into the atmosphere. As you evaporate more seawater in the atmosphere, it dumps more snow on Siberia and Canada. And people have said, well, if you make Canada warmer, won't that stop the snow? Well, it's like warming up Canada from 50 below to 40 below. It's still going to snow. Same thing with Siberia. You can warm it up and it's still going to snow. But once that snow falls on there, it reflects sunlight. And if you cover all of Canada and Siberia with snow and ice, it'll reflect so much heat, it cools the whole planet. And, you know, we have cycles in the Earth's orbit that drives that, but there's also a human contribution. And if Kevin were here, he would tell you, currently there's a huge debate amongst climatologists. To what degree are we humans warming the planet compared to what degree the natural cycles and the variation of Earth's orbit are warming the planet. And the bottom line is the human factor is a minimum of 20% and a maximum of 80%. So that explains why there's a lot of political debate. If you've got an error bar of plus or minus 30%, around 50%, you're going to have people on both sides of the issue.
Just mankind that's causing climate warming. Anytime you see that in the LA Times, climate change, they say it's man-made climate change. They don't even mention natural. And I think the political environment seems to be going that way as well.
Well, there's a good reason for that, and that's because if you look at the variations in the ellipticity of Earth's orbit, it's not enough to explain the current warming. And so that's why they're saying it's got to be a human factor. But again, if Kevin were here, he would tell you it's a whole lot more complex than that. Because basically, the politicians are only looking at carbon dioxide. There's other factors that could be more significant. But what is clearly happening is since 1980, half of the polar ice cap has disappeared. That's a really short time period. In less than 4 decades, half of it is gone. But Kevin's comment is there are papers published saying carbon dioxide cannot melt those polar ice caps that fast, even with the most optimistic estimates. He says he believes the biggest factor is carbon soot, because when black soot falls on the ice, it causes that ice to absorb more heat from the sun. And he says he thinks that's a much bigger factor in melting the polar ice cap. And he says, in one sense, that's good news. Because we can go to India and China and say, you know, if you can just cut down your particulate emissions, that could have an immediate impact on slowing down the melting of the polar ice cap. So that's a lot easier to regulate than trying to cut down carbon dioxide emissions.
Yeah. Okay, so both of those factors are human caused.
Both those factors are human caused.
So which seems to indicate that that human factor is the dominant one.
Well, that's still not, I mean, that's not settled. I mean, there are papers on both sides. There's no doubt that there is a human factor, but to say it's the dominant factor is basically going beyond where the science. It may be the dominant factor. We can't prove it. Again, somewhere between 20% and 80% is human cause. And if it's 80%, that's a big factor, and we should do something about it. But as you've seen in the book I've written on this, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, there are things we can do to stave off the next ice age that would actually increase our economy. And those are the things we need to do because they're easy to sell. Trying to convince people to make economic sacrifices in order to stave off the next ice age, that's difficult to sell, and it doesn't take into account that we humans are sinners. I mean, this is the advantage of a Christian worldview. Don't try to sell something that goes against people's basic sin nature, because the Bible tells us the majority of people, we're all sinners, but the majority of people are not even followers of Jesus Christ. And so trying to get people to make significant economic sacrifices probably won't work. But the good news is there's lots of things we can do that actually put more money into people's pockets. And that's stuff that's easy to sell and stuff that we should do, and we should do it right away. Yes?
Real fast question. In the book of Revelation, it talks about the incredible heat of the oppressive heat people will be enduring, and they curse God for it. What is the maximum heat that you could feasibly live, a human being could feasibly live in this?
Well, that's a good question. We all heard that, is that, okay, if we have increasing global warming, do you reach a point where it becomes difficult for us human beings to survive with that heat? Well, one of the contributors is, okay, when it gets hot, we turn the air conditioning on. But when you turn the air conditioning on, it warms the outside environment. And so if people got access to air conditioning, however, there have already been some incidents. I think the biggest disaster happened in Tehran, where the temperature went above 145, and the people without air conditioning, a lot of people were dying. Because if it's high humidity and 145, unless you're really healthy, you're going to have a hard time surviving that.
So people can actually survive on 130-ish?
No. Well, I was personally in Khartoum with my wife when the temperature was 125 and it was 100% efficiency, or 100% humidity.
Ah. Oh my God.
That was not easy.
Sure.
I mean, we were young at the time. We were in our 30s, and they put us in this room. And I looked in the room, and there were 41 quart bottles filled with water. And I said, what are all these water bottles for? And they said, well, you'll soon find out. Because what happened is, and it still happens in a lot of countries around the world, because of their economy, they turned the electricity off, which meant, and you know, there were no air conditioning. At least we had fans. But then there came a time when the fans weren't working. And we were just sweating profusely, and basically we drank all that water. So, however, unless you're young and fit, it's not easy to keep yourself hydrated enough. Because, I mean, you got to drink a lot of water. And, you know, we never have high humidity here in L.A. Maybe you need to go to Houston sometime in July and see what it's like.
Georgia works.
Yes.
So probably about 120 then you could feasibly fluctuate. I don't think you do that sometimes.
Well, for example, I know a guy who was here in the class. He would work on these boilers for power generation where the temperature would get up to 145 to 150. He could handle that for a few minutes at a time. And so he basically said, hey, if you want me to repair this thing, you got to pay me $200 an hour, and you got to give me all day to put that hour in. And so, because, you know, he would basically go in there, do a few repairs. He knew he could handle it for about 10 or 15 minutes. Then he'd jump out, get himself cooled down again and hydrated. Then he'd go back in and finish the repairs. But you can't do that all day or even do it for a full hour. And so But yeah, I mean, yeah, but so.
The answer to your question is it depends.
Yeah, it depends. Depends how healthy you are and how long you're exposed to those temperatures.
When I was in the Air Force, I was stationed at Dallas Air Force Base in Las Vegas. And in the summertime, sitting under a jet while the engines are running, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they blow hot glass on you from the other flight line. That would be even worse. And it was, we averaged, I think, 110 up there on the pavement. And that was like a living. I was up there 8 hours a day. But I was also 19.
Yeah. Well, I got a similar story. I was at an observatory in Canada, of all places. Canada actually has a desert. It's only 10 square miles. But they put a radio telescope in the middle of that desert because they needed to have the skies that were free of a lot of water in the atmosphere. And there was one summer day when the thermometer broke because the temperature went above 136. So, and this is in the shade. And in Canada, yeah. But we had this special desert, and you know it really did get that warm. But the telescope needed to be I was the youngest guy on site, so they said, you're going to have to fix the receiver. And so I had a cherry picker going up to fix the receiver, and literally they would bring a quart of water up to me every 20 minutes. And I would work on it for two 20-minute sessions, and I'd go back inside, get cooled off, and go back out and work on it again. But how warm it was, I don't know, but I do know that thermometer broke, so.
Couldn't get you to do it at night, huh?
No, in radio astronomy, you can observe 24 hours a day. So, and you know, time is at a rare premium. You don't want to waste any time,
yeah,
so.
But you have to fix it sometime. That could be at night just as easily as in the daytime.
Oh, no, but they wanted to do observations. So it's like, we need it fixed now.
So the observations they needed were objects that were up at night.
No, day and night. Yeah. I mean, this is the challenge of being a radio astronomer, is that there's no time off. You're literally observing 24 hours a day. So, yeah, we used to envy the optical astronomers because they get to sleep. So, because they would give us, 3 days of time. Well, it meant you're up for 72 hours straight. So, I could do that when I was young. I can't do that anymore. Okay, Steve.
Well, you had mentioned about incentives for us to change our habits on global warming, and maybe none of them are quite economically viable enough to help us change. But I think I remember you mentioning that climate change could bring a possible depletion of oxygen and our ability to breathe. Do you remember that? Or?
Okay. I think what I was talking about was carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide and oxygen are related. But during the ice age cycle, at no point does oxygen reach a level that makes it difficult for animals to breathe. However, the carbon dioxide level has a much more dramatic up and down percentage. And what we've noticed in the ice age cycle, each successive ice age is a little more severe than the previous one, for good reason, the Tibetan Plateau is still going up. So that's what makes the successive ice ages more dramatic. And if you cool down the planet, it brings down the carbon dioxide level. And during the last ice age, the carbon dioxide level dropped down to about 240 parts per million. And that's just barely above the minimum that's necessary to sustain photosynthesis. So another reason why humans living during the last ice age were not able to develop the kind of population technology we have today, the crop production just wasn't sufficient. We now have evidence that they were raising crops, harvesting the crops, grinding grains, and making bakery products, but on a very much smaller scale than what was happening, say, even at the Neolithic Revolution. But the Neolithic Revolution is when the carbon dioxide level rose up to a point where now you could really have high productivity crops. And the concern is that the next ice age could be more severe than the previous one. And if it is, the carbon dioxide level might actually drop below the minimum needed to sustain photosynthesis, which would be a catastrophe, an untold catastrophe. So That's another good reason to do what we can to delay the onset of the next ice age. Yes, John.
When I started looking into this about 10 years ago, I found some very interesting things, one of which was an article in Newsweek around 1935 that said there'd been an exceptional amount of melting in the Arctic and they expected the Northwest Passage to be open. I also found out that 1,000 years ago, the Vikings found Greenland a wonderful place to live. It was, they could grow crops, and then after about 100 years, it reverted to normal. And there was also a Chinese naval expedition in the 15th century. They were able to measure their latitude. They couldn't measure longitude, but they could measure latitude. They got to a very high latitude around the Bering Strait, and they reported no icebergs. And that was another period of warming that may have occurred. Also, I had several conversations with a atmospheric sciences specialist at JPL, and he said that the theory of cloud formation is very incomplete. They still can't explain all of the times clouds form or don't form. He also said that getting the data to verify a computer model is almost inconceivable, the amount of data you need to really test a computer model. And I also found out that water vapor has 10 times the effect of carbon dioxide on warming. And the key thing that determines its overall effect is cloud formation. And some Swedes found in around 1995 the cosmic rays played a significant role in forming clouds because they were creating ionization paths, and it affected cloud formation 15%, which is a very large amount. And also I found out about a U.S. Navy exploratory submarine expedition under the ice cap. This was about, I think it was 10 or 15 years ago. Anyway, they reported numerous volcanic calderas, some of them a mile in diameter, and very high water temperatures. And there was never any subsequent investigation of the totality of those formations, and volcanic heating could be a very significant factor in the temperature of the Arctic areas. And then, of course, there's a lot of variations that occurred in the past that have already been very significant and appear to be part of the normal pattern. It may not that from what we're observing today.
Yeah, well, you're making a good point, John, that this is very complicated. I mean, all you need is one really big volcano that's going to cool the planet. But it only cools it for a short period of time. I think what's persuading people that we've got an issue here is that we see carbon dioxide and methane quantity in the atmosphere going up. And we had previous warming and cooling trends. The carbon dioxide and methane was constant. It was these other factors that was driving the climate changes. And these are short-term factors. The concern is what we see in the record of the past history of the Earth is if you got more methane and more carbon dioxide, then you have semi-permanent warming conditions.
Well, I also found there was controversy as to whether the carbon dioxide changes were a cause or an effect of warming trends. And I found some data that showed that the carbon dioxide level tended to increase about 50 years after a warming trend began. So even that is potentially arguable as to...
Well, it is true that there is a time delay between carbon dioxide and warming, but there's no doubt that carbon dioxide, and especially methane, are greenhouse gases.
Yes.
And you're right about the water vapor. It's much more significant, but the water vapor doesn't tend to change that much. If you look at the history of the Earth over the past 4 billion years, the biggest factors determining how much heat is trapped by the atmosphere have been carbon dioxide and methane. And so there's an undisputed correlation between how warm the planet will be and how much carbon dioxide and methane you have. And I think that's what's causing the concern, is that, you know, there's no doubt that carbon dioxide and methane are increasing in the atmosphere.
Yes.
And what can we do about it? And yeah, I'm down to my last 3 minutes, so I was intending to actually get into the book of Isaiah. So
those were good studies, though. I appreciate you bringing those.
Well, the reason I put some time on it, it's relevant to the studies we've done in Genesis 1. And how, you know, the more we learn about science, particularly in the latest scientific literature, it's really giving us greater confidence that we see recorded in Genesis 1 actually does affirm that the Bible is the inspired, inerrant, authoritative Word of God. And I mentioned all this challenge I'm getting in Twitter and Facebook. Atheists are really using Genesis 1 as a weapon and saying, this is nonsense, and if it's nonsense, the whole Bible is nonsense, and Christianity is a nonsense. So the fact that we have emerging scientific discoveries that are giving us greater confidence, hey, even this chapter that you think is the Achilles heel of the Christian faith actually is a powerful piece of evidence that we can trust the Word of God. Yeah, Ken.
I'm here among all of Hugh's friends, and I just want to share with you my compliments to Hugh of the gifts God has given him to wrestle with geology and geochemistry also, in addition to his astronomy.
Well, thank you. And if you've never seen Ken's book on the Grand Canyon, it's a beautiful book. We make it available at Reasons to Believe. And I commend you for the photography you're able to put in that and the diagrams you'll be able to put into that. So
I'll bring the geology. I didn't bring it today. It's at the apartment. But I will give to Ross somehow copies of our geologic timescale card that has a reference to the book on the back. I should have it today, but it didn't cross my mind.
No, that'd be great.
I'll get them here.
I love your little card because I actually hand it out for people to say, because you know, everybody gets confused. What are these periods all about?
Yeah. And so, a few, but I'll give these to Ross, and then he'll have plenty next week for everybody.
So it's not just the few years we've been here, the 4 billion. Well, I mean, what amazes me is the care that you have to put into planet Earth for its first 4.5 billion years to even make it possible for us humans to be here. The meticulous work that God did to prepare the planet for the entry of human beings. And this is part of what we've been talking about. We need the atmosphere to be just so. We need the continents to be just so. In fact, it's an atheist geologist, paleontologist, Peter Ward, who wrote a whole book on why we have to have 29% continental landmass coverage. And he talks about the disaster that would happen if we only had 28% or if we had 30%. 29 is what we need for human civilization and technology. So yeah, don't take those continental land masses for granted. And realize we're living at the one time in the history of the Earth where we've had that magic number of 29%. And yeah, if we're here long enough, it will hit 30%. And when it does, it's bad news. So I commend to you Peter Ward's book. I found it fascinating reading, you know, just how even a tiny change in the continental land mass coverage has devastating consequences for advanced life here on planet Earth. With that, let me pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this privilege of all of us being alive in the 21st century, a time when your book of nature is revealing so much more literally on a daily basis, and how, Lord, we can be comforted by what you said in Psalms and in Job, that the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we see for your supernatural handiwork. Thank you for giving us the privilege of being able to witness this right before our eyes. And Father, I pray you'd help us to use this new revelation of the book of nature to bring people to the book of Scripture, to bring them to the foot of the cross of you, the Creator, that they may receive you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. In Jesus' name, amen.